I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is holding firm in his showdown with Congress as he threatens to block passage of the pandemic relief bill. And the symbolism on this day before Christmas is not lost on members of Congress who negotiated for months over that bill. Here's Michigan's Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell speaking on the House floor earlier today.
It is not a silent night. All is not calm. For too many, nothing is bright. And for too many, they are not sleeping peacefully.
House Democrats failed today to pass a measure that would increase relief payments to $2,000. Republicans objected, even though Trump called on lawmakers to do it and raise the $600 payments he criticized as ridiculously low. If Trump doesn't sign the bill, millions of Americans will lose their unemployment benefits after Christmas, and the federal government will be forced to shut down next week. Let's bring in NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, start with those relief payments. Trump asked lawmakers to raise them after the bill was already passed. Democrats have fought with Republicans for months over this issue of higher direct payments. Your thoughts on what happens now?
So House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in a statement afterwards that the GOP cruelly blocked these payments and Trump should call on Republicans to stop their, quote, obstruction. Now she says she's going to try again on Monday to call for a roll call vote on the plan. This would put lawmakers on the record on how they feel about these $2,000 in direct payments. She also said she hopes by then the president will sign the spending package because if not, Congress will need to pass a new stopgap measure to avoid a government shutdown Monday night. The frustration is palpable on Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle, as we heard Debbie Dingell at the top there with her frustration. And she said that, quote, President Trump doesn't give a damn. And she literally begged him to sign the bill because people are hurting.
Well, as you said, he's got that stopgap measure to keep it open, but he's blasting that spending bill as wasteful. What's the issue?
Well, it appears to be a misunderstanding of what all this legislation does. At least that's what Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt told reporters at the Capitol today. And what he and others are referring to is this massive package included two different pieces of legislation, one focused on coronavirus relief aid, and the other is what's referred to as an omnibus spending bill. It funds the government for an entire year, for its full fiscal year, which actually began in October. But Trump was pointing to some of these measures in the government funding portions of this package and trying to connect that to the economic stimulus bill. So it's all very confusing and for many doesn't make sense, especially since the White House on Monday urged Republicans to approve this plan the same day of the vote and the passage of this bill.
Now, how likely is a shutdown?
So right now, a shutdown is something that Congress does not want to see, especially over the holidays. So the expectation and what they're telling us is they will rush back to D.C. to make sure that they approve some sort of short-term funding bill. They're already due back in town next week in time for this deadline if Trump indeed does not sign this bill by the end of the weekend, and they could approve this measure. So right now, it looks pretty unlikely when we look at Congress. Mm-hmm.
Claudia, elsewhere in the program, we're going to take up the president's many pardons last night of allies and an in-law. But also yesterday, he vetoed the $740 billion defense bill, as expected, over that provision that gives legal protection to social media companies. He wanted that out. Congressional leaders say they plan to override that veto. You know, just what's your sense of, in about the minute we have left, of whether Republicans really are going to cross him on all of these demands?
Yes, this is pretty remarkable. Trump has vetoed bills before, but they've never seen one of these vetoes overridden by Congress. They need two-thirds of their members to vote for an override, and it looks like it may happen in this case. He threatened multiple times to veto this bill, so they already planned for it. And so Monday and Tuesday, we're going to see the House and the Senate come back. They've already seen these supermajorities support this bill when they passed the final version earlier this month, and they expect to do that again, which would mark the very first time that Congress will override one of these vetoes during Trump's administration.
Well, and we have to say it clearly, the first time many Republicans have crossed him on anything. So this will be interesting to watch.
In this way, yes.
Yeah. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks so much.
There was a moment of reckoning with the nation's past this week in Washington, D.C., a moment you might have missed. Monday morning, workers removed Virginia's statue of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee from the U.S. Capitol. A new statue of Barbara Rose Johns will replace it. She's a heroine of the student civil rights movement, and we want to find out more about her. Joining us now is Cameron Patterson, executive director of the Robert Russa Moten Museum. It's dedicated in part to preserving Barbara Johns' legacy at the site of her old high school in Farmville, Virginia. Cameron, welcome.
Great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure. And Cameron, when we say student civil rights movement, people will likely know the name Ruby Bridges, the first black child to desegregate her elementary school in New Orleans in 1960. But Ruby Bridges couldn't have done that if it weren't for Barbara Johns. Remind us what she did at Moton High School in 1951.
Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty amazing that before these monumental moments in the civil rights movement that we've come to know pretty vividly, there was this young 16-year-old student who, along with 450 of her classmates, really walked out of school and into history. The strike at Moton High School, Robert Russa Moton High School, on April the 23rd of 1951, really set into motion a lot of important events that would help lead to the desegregation of our public school system. That student strike would lead to a local court case, Davis versus County School Board of Prince Edward, which would become one of the five that would make up Brown v. Board of Education. And I always like to tell folks that of the cases that made up Brown, the Prince Edward case was the only student-initiated case, and about 75% of the plaintiffs in Brown v. Board of Education came from right here in Prince Edward County, Virginia.
And tell us more about why Johns and her classmates were protesting in the first place. How did Moton High School compare to nearby schools where white students went?
First and foremost, the students were pretty concerned with the inadequacies of their high school compared to the all-white schools that resided in Prince Edward County, and even other all-black high schools that they would visit across the Commonwealth. And so really, I think, you know, it begins with the overcrowdedness of Robert Russa Moton High School, built for 180 students. And at the time of the student walkout, there were 450 or more students that were in that school building taking classes. And then it kind of proceeded with the lack of educational equipment offered to the students, the tar paper shack structures built on the property as the county's way of alleviating overcrowding. So those are the conditions that really prompted this action from the students.
Well, as you say, the case goes all the way to the Supreme Court because, along with four other cases like it, it'll become the basis for Brown v. Board of Education. We know that legally, technically ended segregation. How much credit does Barbara Johns deserve for all that?
Well, you know, I think she deserves credit for being the catalyst for helping to begin a profound movement within our country. I think it's important to also remember this idea of collective action. And so I think, you know, she deserves that credit as being the one with the vision. I think her classmates deserve that credit for the courage and sacrifice that it took to really go through with this effort. And I think that's really what is at the heart of this story in Prince Edward County, is that at every turn, it's a story of young people seeking to bring about change.
You know, that is the amazing part of this story. Barbara Johns is being honored for the work that she did as a child. And after all of this was settled at the Supreme Court, she went on to lead a pretty quiet life. She died in 1991, and now she is replacing Virginia's statue of Robert E. Lee in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. It is profound. What does it mean to you?
It is. You know, I have often, over the last couple of weeks, used the word transformative. You know, I think just the thought of when that statue is placed in the U.S. Capitol and young people will be able to look up into her eyes and they'll see in her someone who was about helping to better the community around them. And I hope that they will use that inspiration in their own lives.
We hope so too. Cameron Patterson, Executive Director of the Robert Russa Moton Museum in Farmville, Virginia. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
We're going to take a look back now on some of the big stories in world news this year as we close out a chaotic 2020. Christiane Amanpour is chief international correspondent for CNN. She also hosts Amanpour & Company on PBS, and she joins us now on Skype. Christiane, welcome back. It's always great to have you on the show.
It's wonderful to be with you, Peter.
And what a terrible year it has been for so many people around the world. How would you even start to sum it up?
Well, look, you're right. And one of the words that has become overused, but absolutely correct, is unprecedented. Certainly in our modern history, we have never faced something like this. You've had, you know, so many people put out of work, so many governments trying to make up for the economic pain, so many people also disproportionately affected who are doing perhaps the most essential work on the front lines. On the other hand, for the lucky segment of the population, which has been privileged enough to have high-speed Wi-Fi, the ability to work remotely, the ability to be flexible, you know, they have suffered less.
You may remember it was New Year's Eve 2019 when the Wuhan Municipal Health Commission in China reported a cluster of pneumonia cases, and that would prove to be the novel coronavirus that we're all familiar with now, that you just described, how terrible it's been. And I remember in the early days of the outbreak, speaking with journalists who were taking tremendous steps just to get into the city that was under strict lockdown. We were talking to people getting pulled off of cruise ships and flown back to the United States under quarantine, but we really had no idea what was coming. How do you think history will judge this huge international story that we're still in the middle of?
I believe history will judge this by the total disregard for science and fact by the most important countries that should have known better. We will always remember, and it brings sometimes, even now, tears to my eyes. I feel quite emotional when I recall what you just said. You painted a picture of what was going on at the beginning of last year, the drama, the panic, the unknown, the darkness, the what do we do to survive this? You know, do we all just hunker down forever? What's going to happen? And then, you know, you remember that there were pandemic books that were written. There were manuals that were written and not taken up, whether in the US or Britain. And yet in many countries, whether it be in Vietnam or South Korea or wherever it might be, New Zealand stands out as a massively impressive example. Governments and leaders, you know, reacted instantly and were guided by the science. Yes, we're in a very, very dangerous second and third wave in some cases right now, but it's the beginning where people will be judged.
Well, to that point, this tested world leaders around the world in ways that they had never been tested before, and some performed quite differently than others. China, of course, at the center of the outbreak. But, you know, China made other headlines this year. It took major steps to limit democratic freedoms in Hong Kong. How do you think this year will judge China and its shifting role in the world?
China has used this year as well, as you say, to crack down hard on democracy in Hong Kong, and we've been covering it. And China under Xi Jinping has become much more authoritarian, much richer, much more successful in many ways, but politically repressive. And now Hong Kong, which people thought China would never dare touch, is suffering huge consequences, huge consequences.
Another story I want to touch on is something that happened here at home and then spread around the world, and that, of course, is George Floyd, who died in police custody in Minneapolis. In France, that story became part of the country's Justice for Adama movement, referring to a man who died in police custody in 2016. I want to listen to this sound, protesters in Paris chanting his name this summer. Were you surprised how the George Floyd protest movement caught fire abroad?
No, I wasn't actually, because it was such a horrendous image. It was such a shock to humanity. It was such an affront to every aspect of decency that we in the West and in the democratic world pretend to uphold. It was such a disgrace that it is one of those massive turning point moments and game-changing moments, not just in the United States, but around the world, which also continues to grapple with its racist past, its colonial past. If you're talking about here in Europe, we've seen protests all over in Belgium, in the UK, as you mentioned, in France, all over. And I think one of the things that I've spoken many times to American civil rights leaders and all the activists, they have been and they've drawn a lot of, I think, comfort and energy from seeing how their struggle is reflected and endorsed and supported and joined abroad. So I think that's massively important. We've kept our eye on it all year since the end of May, when that terrible, he was killed, he was executed, he was assassinated in front of cameras with people standing there shouting, please, he can't breathe, leave him alone. It is unacceptable that that happened. And really, all our societies have to reckon with it. I hope 2021 will build on the momentum of 2020 and that we will have real reckonings and not just verbal testimonials. Whatever kind of reparations, truth, and reconciliation that can take place. South Africa gave us an example. It is not exactly precise an example, but we can learn from what other countries and other racist systems have done to tear down those walls of racism and to try to atone for that very, very dark and unjust past.
Yeah, and it, as all of that was happening, more traditional conflicts were happening. And I mean in the sense that long simmering tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijani forces broke out into violence in Nagorno-Karabakh. There was a civil war. There is a civil war breaking out in Ethiopia. A U.S. drone strike killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani back in January. Here's the sound of mourners in Tehran after that happened. So as we head into 2021, what do you think? Is the world, does it feel like a more or less stable place than where the year started?
No, it doesn't. It absolutely does not. And I would say that with the new administration coming in, many nations, adversary and ally, will be looking for a more stable, a foreign policy that hews to more of the norms that one is used to the United States leading. I think, you know, Iran, of course, started with that assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the most senior military leader, and ended with the assassination of the most senior nuclear scientist and developer. So there's been a huge amount of effort by the United States and its allies, whether it be Israel or the Gulf nations, to try to sideline and perhaps even topple the Iranian regime, perhaps even try to create regime change. So the challenge for the Biden administration is to potentially go back into that nuclear deal. Obviously, the ground has shifted a lot and it'll be difficult, but allies are really, really hoping that across the board, whether it's NATO, whether it's supporting democracy around the world, we've been reporting on the erosion of democracy, the increase of authoritarianism, even in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Poland. We've watched the fraudulent elections in Belarus. We have watched the beating up of the opposition candidate in Uganda, Uganda being a strong U.S. ally. I think 2021 will be about health, the economy, and hopefully about rebuilding democracy and guarding democracy, and also a continuation of a desperately needed racial reckoning. Mm.
I hear you. You've given a very sober look at the world for good cause, of course. It's been a terrible year. Is there any reason for hope? We have seen the Taliban in Afghanistan continue very difficult peace talks. Also, Israel and some Arab nations are taking steps to normalize diplomatic relations. Do you see any hope in those areas?
Well, I certainly think Israel and those Arab nations who have normalized, we won't call them peace accords because they were never at war. They were normalization accords, will obviously be of benefit to that part of the world. However, that has left as a casualty and a consequence the fact that the main show in that part of the world has not been addressed, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That is still simmering, and unless that is resolved in a fair, just, secure, equitable way for all parties concerned, that is still going to be a thorn in the side. We have seen what you've just called a peace accord or peace deals trying to be hammered out. It's not working. The Taliban, all they want to do is see the United States retreat. They want to go back to their oppression of women. They want to go back to their very fundamentalist Islamic State, even though they say they don't. That is what we're seeing on the ground. So we need to be really careful about that. But hope for me lies in the individuals, in the incredible scientists, whether it's BioNTech, whether it's, remember, the immigrants, the people who created the first vaccine to be approved are Turkish immigrants into Germany. I think it's an amazing story. And I think the general global scientific achievement is phenomenal. To me, that gives me massive, massive hope. And I think each and every individual who's been on the front line and on the essential workforce during this pandemic have been people who we need to really sort of get on our knees and thank, because they've been amazing. The power of the individual will, the power of individual kindness and compassion and care, I think have stood out as much as some of the dereliction of duty by the governments who refuse to take science and the like seriously.
That's Christiane Amanpour, chief international anchor of CNN's Amanpour. Thank you for taking some time to bear witness with us. What a difficult year this has been. I'm sure we'll speak to you again in 2021. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now a story that might not be for little ears, because it's about Santa. Know what I'm saying? Okay, they're gone. Turns out the pandemic has put a lot of those guys out of work. Some are shielding behind plexiglass at the mall or doing virtual visits, but many are older and sitting this season out. Connecticut Public Radio's Ryan Caron King has the story of one who did not let a virus keep him home.
George McCleary is a horticulturist and a vegetable farmer. Around this time of year, he's also a Santa. He's been putting on the red coat for about four decades, but he's now 66 and borderline diabetic, so he wasn't sure how he could safely do his Santa visits in the middle of a pandemic.
A month before Santa season, I was getting ready and I was trying to decide how we're going to do some of these visits that we've done in the past, because a lot of them were in people's houses. And my doctor just said, no, you can't go in their houses.
So McCleary bought a new laptop and a microphone. He was about to send out his availability for doing his Santa visits virtually.
And I never sent the hours in. because this idea popped in my head. Well, maybe we could put a trailer or put a sleigh on it and go visit people.
A day later, he found a red trailer for sale on the side of the road. He bought a sleigh, put it on the trailer with some lights, and posted a note to a local Facebook group about doing Santa visits.
The first night, I got 50 phone calls. Can you come to our house? Can you come to our house? And it's just started, and it's just rolling, snowballing.
McCleary is the president of the Connecticut Santa Society, and he says most of his members are staying home this season because of the pandemic. But people still need Santa.
One of the things when we sing and dance, when we're singing and get the kids to dance, the smiles on those parents' faces is just a treasure. Even when we're driving down the road with this trailer, we're going down Route 8, somebody will pull up next, start to go by, they'll put their brake on, they'll come even with our vehicle, they'll roll their windows down, and out come the cell phones. Click, 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 and they're laughing and they're talking. Just to put a smile on people's faces.
Put part of the lights on.
McCleary climbs into his truck for the next visit. This will be his 10th stop of the day.
You know, what I'm doing is not for every Santa, because the biggest thing the farm has given me is being able to back this trailer up. I'm used to backing farm wagons and all kinds of equipment up all my life. So this is kind of like second nature to me.
At his next stop, McCleary pulls his truck up to a group of kids and parents. They sing for him as he plugs in his lights and climbs up onto the trailer.
Can you see me?
We can see you! Yay!
All right, I heard you singing some songs. How about if we sing a couple other ones?
McCleary is flanked by Mrs. Claus, his wife in real life, and a friend who plays an elf. He tells the crowd he's using his everyday sleigh right now. You know, the one he takes to the grocery store.
Did everybody get a present?
Thank you.
Okay, well now I gotta go visit some other boys.
As McCleary carefully backs his trailer down the driveway, Margaret Sagafi says she was happy he could be a part of her family's holiday. She's a nurse in the COVID unit at a local hospital, and she and her husband got the virus earlier this year.
It's been a difficult year, just professionally, at work, and then just in our personal lives, having had it, it's been difficult. But things like this make, lighten the mood, and they make it special.
And Sagafi says she enjoyed seeing her kids' excitement as much as the kids enjoyed seeing Santa himself. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Karen King.
We talked this week about handling grief this time of year and during a pandemic. But as many as a quarter of Americans are facing something that often feels like death, but it's not. It's the purgatory of estrangement. The I'm done. I've had it with this family. You will never see me or my children again. You are dead to me. Cutting off of loved ones. Sociologist Carl Pillemer did a study on estrangement and says, first, if you are estranged, you're not alone. Did you know Christopher Robin, the real-life son of author A.A. Milne and the model for the Christopher Robin in the Winnie the Pooh books, was estranged from his dad for a lifetime? He said his father stole his childhood. And Pillemer also found what family members do to each other when they estrange, they do to future generations who are left wondering what happened or left to repeat the same behavior. And except, of course, when it's dangerous, healing from even some of the worst estrangements is possible. Carl Pillemer is professor of human development at Cornell University. His book is Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them. He joins us from Ithaca, New York. And Carl, you've had family experience with this, but you were still surprised at the impact of estrangement?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. One of the things I found is how profoundly difficult this is. I sort of knew that, but through interviewing several hundred people, I didn't realize the degree to which they felt it was a death, an open wound. I also learned how isolated people feel, that they have a sense of shame. So it's a very stressful and stigmatizing, and for most people, isolating experience, especially around the holidays.
Well, you point out to us that this has been described as something called ambiguous loss. It was a phrase coined by therapist Pauline Boss. While people are physically absent from each other, they're psychologically present. People on both sides of this chasm might be thinking all the time about it, even for years. What are some of the reasons that people become estranged?
I was able to uncover some key pathways to how people get to this. One of them I called the long arm of the past. Through a history of harsh parenting or emotional or physical abuse and neglect, or even less extreme things like parental favoritism or sibling rivalry, a more proximal cause we found is what I termed the problematic in-law. As the family of origin struggles with the family of marriage, a third key pathway is money and inheritance. So wills, inheritance, and business issues. And finally, there's the area of differences in values and expectations. So we really found that expectations can emerge from a disapproval of a relative's core values, which then can turn into outright rejection. And someone coming to that point where they say, I'm done, I never want to speak to you or hear from you again.
I'm done. I mean, you tell such painful stories. There's the woman who fell in love with another woman. Her mother could not accept this relationship, would come to the house. At one point, the adult daughter, had to call the police on her own mother and for her own sake decided she had to estrange from this mother. But you also describe grandparents absolutely sick at heart, you know, trying to sneak on Facebook to get a look at children that have been removed from them. I mean, describe some of the pain that you're seeing.
Estrangements constitute a kind of chronic stress. Because even in situations where the person is very difficult, if you've grown up with a parent or a sibling, you have these irrational bonds of attachment to them. Another reason why it's painful is based in decades of social psychological research showing that when you're personally rejected, it basically violates a lot of what helps to support our psychological well-being. And the feeling of powerlessness that really bothers people as well. For almost everybody, you hear this profound sadness, a sense of incompleteness in their life, and that really pushes some people towards at least the idea of reconciliation.
Well, I want to talk about that, how to do that. But first, what did you find about how this impacts the concentric circles around two people who've become estranged? You know, whole families have to split. Some people may, you know, not see beloved cousins and always be thinking about them.
And I call it collateral damage. Innocent bystanders are profoundly impacted by estrangements. Often, say, if in the parental generation there's a fight over a business or a rift, it spreads its way down into the next generations so that cousins who may have grown up together become estranged from one another through no fault of their own. And I had many people talk about that, how they'd been part of a warm extended family that was really rent asunder by an estrangement. There also is the difficulty of being caught in the middle. So I was privileged to be able to interview a number of college students who had estrangements in their families. And they would go home and all the conversation with mom was around what her siblings had done to her over the last 3 months. It got in the way of their own development. So one thing I do encourage people to think about is before you say to someone in your family, it's over, I'm never going to see you again, think about the impact on future generations. Do you really want your children to have no contact with their children? I experienced this in my own family in the grandparental generation, where there's a whole side of the family about whom I know nothing, who might have been there to be supportive and wonderful relatives.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about how you're cutting off future generations from resources. That's what extended family is. Okay, so how do you mend this? Yes, there are people who it may not be safe for them too, but you talked to young adults who left incredibly abusive parents and then found their way back to a sort of relationship. You say that the people who do this, the number one thing that's a motivator is you do it for yourself.
You know, I'm so glad you raised that because I actually had someone say, I didn't do this for my father. He can go jump in the lake as far as that's concerned. I reconciled because it was for me. It stuck in my mind how a guy who had been estranged from his brother for 25 years said, I woke up that morning after I called him for the first time the day before, and I said, wow, I'm no longer thinking about the fact that I haven't spoken to my brother for 25 years. So a couple of things I would encourage people to think of. First is to really think if you're ready to reconcile And some signs of that, you start feeling anticipated regret. This has occurred to people in the pandemic. Will it be too late? You also have to think about if the circumstances have changed. The person may be different. I also encourage people to develop a plan. And that's where counseling can be really helpful, is to think of what you want out of the restored relationship, what you'll do if the other person is not willing to do so. So you can think about some protective things. I did find that people who successfully reconciled had several things in common. They explored their own role in the estrangement. So they didn't accept blame, but they looked at how they might have been involved, and that empowered them. We also found that people needed to reduce their expectations, realizing that the sibling or parent's not going to become that ideal person you wanted.
Well, and you may not get the porcelain vase that your sibling got when an estate was settled. You have to give up on being right, right?
That's wonderfully stated. I'd say the most important thing that people did, people got over that desire to have the other person admit that they'd been a terrible parent, terrible sibling. And interestingly, they abandoned often the need for an apology. Those who reconciled learned that an apology wasn't necessary, and in fact often occurred after the reconciliation. People have to decide there are some individuals who are in either dangerous or emotionally devastating right. past relationships who should only try this if they're also benefiting from counseling of some kind. I will say that there was one experience that really united people who had reconciled. Almost 100% of people said, this was one of the major achievements of my adult life. I do have one very specific piece of advice for people, though.
Yeah.
One thing that many people said is addressing all these family issues at a holiday gathering is not really the right time. Wait until a more opportune and less emotionally laden time.
Boy, Carl Pillemer, again, the book is Fault Lines, Fractured Families, and How to Mend Them. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
A new NBA season just tipped off on Tuesday night, and surprise, surprise, COVID-19 is already gumming up the schedule. Last night's game between the Houston Rockets and Oklahoma City Thunder was postponed because the Rockets didn't have enough players. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, what happened last night? Why wasn't this game played?
You have to have more than eight players. The Rockets had a few already who were injured, and then a positive test came back for one player. That doesn't mean that he's definitely positive. They'll have to retest. But the protocols and contact tracing indicate that other players should be quarantining. That put the available number down below the threshold. And what should have been an all-league effort, including the two games the night before where you had the Lakers, the returning champion, playing the Clippers, and you had this great game, the Brooklyn Nets playing the Golden State Warriors, and then all the teams were supposed to play yesterday. Well, the Rockets and OKC Thunder cannot play.
Well, for most of last season, the NBA played in a bubble. All the teams were in Orlando, and in terms of COVID, that worked pretty well. Now, this season, the teams are playing in their own arenas again, and the pandemic is clearly still raging. Why did the NBA go back to the old version of things?
Yeah, it did work well. There were no positive tests in the bubble. And I would say it was two reasons, and both of them monetary, but also rational. The bubble itself cost upwards of $200 million. Estimates $180 million. So, you know, it's cost prohibitive. And the other thing is they looked at the NFL, and the NFL had success. If you define success as they have been able to play all their games with 2 weeks in the schedule left. There was a lot of shifting around. There's a lot of criticism, some of it apt. But I think the NBA said, you know, if we can do it with our smaller rosters and not burgeoning teams of coaches and personnel, if the NFL could do it, we could give it a try and maybe save some money along the way. And they're at least taking it seriously and, say, canceling that Rockets Thunder game.
And what about the hockey season? That starts in January. What's their plan?
Interesting schedule. Yeah, January 30th. So hockey has about a quarter of its teams based in Canada. And Canada's totally a totally different situation, totally different rules, totally different laws. In fact, the one Canadian NBA team, the Raptors, have moved to Tampa because it would be impossible logistically to get that Canadian team incorporated into the NBA. So they created an all-Canadian division. And in fact, they created four divisions, and the teams in those divisions, eight teams or so, will just be playing each other. And this limits the traveling. Most of the schedule will be each team's play each other twice in a row, so they don't have to keep moving arenas. And it won't be until the playoffs between any teams outside these divisions will face each other. Also, if you look at the NHL schedule, when they list home arena, it says TBD because they don't know if all the arenas or which arenas will be available.
That is interesting. Mike, college football, I'll be honest, I missed the famous Idaho Potato Bowl this year. Nevada beat Tulane 38-27. Sorry, Green Wave. But really, the games that will help decide this season's college football champion will be played, as usual, on New Year's Day. And it seems like there's always an argument about who makes the playoff field. This year is even stranger because Ohio State, a powerhouse, a perennial powerhouse, missed so many games to COVID.
Yeah, it is. And just a note on that famous Potato Bowl, I can understand missing it. It was up against the roofclaim.com bowl. But, you know, these little tiny bowls are often just a joke. But this year, they're a dangerous joke to make these teams play in different situations for, I don't know, nothing but the glory and remuneration of the bowl sponsors. That said, you're absolutely right. Ohio State has only played six games, and they didn't look so great winning those six. So you have other teams saying, hey, we played 11 games. We're not faulting Ohio State for having, you know, to deal with their conference getting a late jump and games being canceled. But how do you reward a team that played half the games over us if we're Texas A&M?
Yeah.
But there's a bigger issue, which is that the college football playoffs really has only rewarded a thin cluster of teams. And Alabama always deserves to be there, and Clemson usually deserves to be there. But then they just kind of default to a team like Ohio State based on perception, based on recruiting class, and based on something other than what they've done on the field. So it is a situation in terms of competition and fairness for college football.
Maybe it's too early to ask this, but I'm going to do it anyways. Is March Madness in jeopardy again?
Well, it doesn't seem so, but the pandemic, of course, will have its own plans. But the NCAA is so dead set on doing absolutely everything that they can to get March Madness in. If you compare it to every other sport, you know, you have millionaire and players and billionaire owners in the other professional sports. But with March Madness, the NCAA is absolutely dependent on the revenue for March Madness. So I think that if one sporting event is to be played, it will be March Madness because the incentives are all there.
I mean, speaking of money, oh my goodness, there's a lot of money involved there. Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.